Hello and welcome to Rustation Station. I'm your host, Alan Wyma, and today I'm with Zach Lloyd, the founder and CEO of Warp. Now, the reason, of course, I brought him on is because he's making a terminal client in Rust. Of course, this is not the first terminal client written in Rust, I think. I think that belongs to Alacrity. But nonetheless, I'm quite impressed with Warp. I've been playing around with it for the last week or so. And I have to say, I'm pretty proud to say that it is my new favorite terminal for the time being. So I hope you're happy to hear that. But otherwise, you know, Zach, why don't you kind of give also a quick introduction about yourself?
Thanks, Alan, for having me here. I'm excited to be here and talk about Warp and building in Rust. And like Alan said, I'm the founder and CEO of Warp. Excited to talk about how we're building it.
Yeah. So why don't we kind of step back a little bit, right? Because using Rust to create, this is almost like a, I mean, would you say that GUIs are actually, or sorry, that terminals are actually similar with GUIs? I mean, or is it like, because there's this big thing within Rust that people are always asking, you know, what's the GUI framework I should use? And there's a website called Are We GUI Yet? I think, I don't know if you've seen that one yet. And people are super interested in this topic, right?
Yeah, for sure.
So would you say that Warp is actually like some of a GUI app itself?
It's definitely a GUI app. So Warp is, it's a native Mac app. We basically do all of the rendering ourselves. And so we looked at a bunch of Rust UI frameworks. I think UI in Rust is something that is getting better and a lot of people are interested in. If you think about like what a terminal is, it's basically emulating a piece of physical hardware that hasn't existed in a long time, or it's just not in wide use anymore. And so, yeah, when you're building a terminal, you are effectively building a GUI.
Okay. And actually, I do have a question for you. Is why are those called a terminal emulator? Is it because we're emulating like the old style terminals from a long time ago? Or what? Why is
that? Yeah, so that's exactly right. So terminal used to be like a physical hardware device. In fact, there's one particular piece of hardware, which is the VT100, which is made by DEC, so Digital Equipment. And it used to be like an actual, like you would have a screen basically, and you'd have like a keyboard, and it was like a very simple sort of input output oriented device. And that architecture continues today. So when you're running a terminal emulator, you're actually running a GUI that is sort of copying the behavior of that device. Of course, it's like rendering in a window on your computer, but it's doing more or less the same thing. And so when you run that terminal, what it does is it starts up a shell and it sends, like as you're typing in your keyboard on your Mac, basically taking those key events, we're sending them into the shell. The shell is the command interpreter. So it's like, it sort of parses what you're typing and it echoes characters back. And then when you hit enter, essentially the shell runs program and it wires everything up so that the characters that are coming back from that program come back to the terminal. And you can sort of like the terminal, you can think of it as just like, it's like a rendering device for characters in some sense. So it's like if you've ever done like programming on the web, it's sort of like, it's a very primitive sort of DOM for characters. It's kind of a very, very basic way of looking at it. So that kind of old school architecture is what a terminal does today, even though it's running on like your very fancy Mac or Linux machine or Windows machine.
Okay. And I'm really curious, like what got you interested in making something like this? Because this is quite an endeavor, right? And also the landscape is quite crowded, no?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So I've been a programmer for, I don't know, over 20 years now. And I still remember when I was learning how to program, like there are a few tools that I used. One was a terminal, one was code editor. I can't remember what my first like IDE was, but I used to do all of my coding in Emacs, basically in the terminal. And so I've used the tool forever. And I feel like in the last 20 years, the landscape around sort of code editors has really changed quite a bit. Like I feel like You have code editors have improved a decent amount. You have like VS Code, I feel like is sort of the new standard for what people use when they're using a code editor. But the terminal experience is more or less unchanged. I think there's been a lot of innovation around sort of the margins. And so there are some great open source products that make terminals more powerful. Like for instance, like OhMyZSH is a really good example. Or I think Tmux is another really good example if you want to like manage sessions, or FZF. These are all like very popular things that make the terminal more powerful. But the actual like terminal itself, when you run the app, is more or less what it was. And, you know, as someone who's used it for a long time, I've always kind of had a set of things that I've thought were like basically pretty weird about it or suboptimal from a product perspective. And, sort of more recently when I was thinking about, is there a product that I really want to spend a lot of time working on? I kind of kept coming back to the terminal as being a cool product to try and innovate on in some place where I thought there's actually like a lot of potential for improvement. So that's kind of, you know, I've been using it forever. And then I got, you know, more and more excited about actually building something modern to innovate on it.
But what kind of things could a terminal, updated terminal, do versus, like you said, adding in kind of these extra programs like OhMyZSH, things like that?
Yeah, so the big difference with Warp compared to using, OhMyZSH, for instance, is that we're trying to change a few of the UI primitives that are in a terminal, and so. You can think of a terminal having like sort of primitives around input and primitives around output, and we're sort of changing both. On the input side, what's different about Warp, and you've probably noticed this as you've used it, is that we have like a text editor that works a lot more like what people are probably used to when working in like VS Code or even like Google Docs or Microsoft Word. It's like a kind of buffered text editor where it sort of natively supports the normal mouse interactions, the normal sort of selection and delete interactions that people have in their other apps. And on top of that, it also is like, since we've sort of taken over that UI component, we can do really nice things to improve the experience. Like we can do multi-cursor editing, for instance, or we could do code folding and syntax highlight if we wanted to be really fancy. And so we can sort of make the input experience into the terminal feel much more like it does in the rest of your apps, which I think has the potential to make the terminal much more pleasant. On the other hand, if you're trying to do something like that using like OhMyZSH or another just like shell plugin, you have no chance to actually introduce that type of experience into the terminal. It really does require actually sort of rebuilding and changing the way the UI of the app works. You can't kind of extend the terminal to do that through a plugin. The other big difference that we have on the UI side is we have this concept of blocks, and it's really related to the way that output works in the terminal. So in a normal terminal, the rendering is really just one big character buffer, meaning like, kind of like I alluded to before, like the terminal screen is like a sort of blank canvas for characters to be drawn on. And that's necessary for a lot of apps. But a lot of the times when people use the terminal, they're actually using it kind of like a shell-based like REPL, where they like run a command, see an output, run a command, see an output. And what we've done with blocks is sort of introduce a UI primitive that captures those outputs. And so it's like in Warp, when you have an output, we associate the command you ran with the output it produced in one unit that's a block. And the cool thing about that is like you can then navigate your terminal a block at a time. So it's like it makes like scrolling through your terminal history much nicer. And then you have like a sort of natural entity or object in your terminal that you can take actions on. And so, for instance, if you want to copy paste, you have structure around what you've done. And so you can sort of copy paste. If you want to share, if you want to rerun, again, you have like a sort of object, which is a prior command that you ran and its output, which you now know structure around, and you can do really useful, cool things with that. And again, you couldn't really bolt that on. It's sort of something that needs to be done by building a terminal around it.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Do you think that there's a way that Warp could actually open up some kind of API so other kind of plugins could actually plug into them? I'm not talking about like just within the terminal itself, but I'm thinking like you mentioned, these terminal shell extensions could actually do some more interesting stuff.
Yeah, I think that's an awesome idea. It's something we would like to build. Like, for instance, one really cool use case that Warp could open up is the ability to write like a sort of custom renderer for a particular output type. And so, for instance, if you had a command that produced, say, like JSON as an output, and you wanted like an object viewer UI in Warp, what would be cool is if we opened up something like a way of taking advantage of the fact that we know what a block is and feeding structured data into it and letting someone else write a renderer. So you could do that for JSON. You could do it for a CSV. You could do it for different image types, chart types. And I think you could even do it not just for rendering, but you could do it for like action triggers would be like, if, you know, if you really want to take it further, but it's like basically something that is, looking at the output of a command, sort of filtering it and triggering some sort of workflow off it or some other action. So we definitely have the vision of like, you know, creating an ecosystem around making the UI of the command line more powerful and extensible.
But do you think that this could be a bit of an issue, right? If only Warp did something like this, like if you're going to do something like this, do you think that you'd want to kind of try to open source this idea and share some of this? Because yeah, we'd kind of be like back into the stage where it's like, oh, this page is where is best seen on Microsoft Internet Explorer, right? This kind of experience where people would be missing out on something.
Yeah, I think the best thing to do for something like this would be to create some sort of standard around it, where if you are building a terminal, and there may be some work done on this, like if you look at Kitty has something like this, it's another terminal. But basically some sort of standard where if you're a terminal author, you can support like a type of plugin that would take the output of a command and do something cool with it. Like one sort of potential analogy that I sometimes use when talking about this is like, if you look at the way email works, so email, you can send an email that's text email. But you can send it with like a MIME extension where you can also send an HTML email with it, for instance. And if the client supports an HTML rendering, then great, you get an HTML rendering. If the email client only does a text rendering, then you fall back to text rendering. So I think creating some sort of standard like that for people who are doing work in the command line might make sense. I'll caveat this by saying, like, I have not fully thought through how this should work, but I agree with the notion of like, let's make a standard around it and let's make it usable in, you know, other places as well.
Yeah. I kind of like this idea that you're kind of starting up something that could really make the terminal experience much better. I do agree that like, yeah, terminals have been kind of stalled for a certain extent. Like, has there really been any kind of improvements to a terminal for the last 10 years or so? I mean, I can't think of too much. I mean, tabbing is probably one of the biggest ones. Anything else kind of comes to mind?
Yeah, I mean, I do think terminals themselves are getting better. Like on Mac, I think iTerm definitely has like some really cool features and has done a bunch of innovative things. And like iTerm has like, let's see, like what are some of the cool things? Like split panes are nice. Tabbing is nice. You have nice facilities for sort of working with hyperlinks and sort of like clicking out. You can sort of drag files in and get file paths from them. iTerm has like some cool features that like let you set up a tool belt. So I think on the feature side, I definitely think there has been a bunch of innovation. I want to give credit there. Like I think iTerm's a pretty cool app. On the like performance side, I think Alacrity is really good. Like Alacrity is a very bare bones, but very performance focused terminal. That's also like is written in Rust. And we actually have some open source dependencies on some of the Alacrity code. So it's like, I think they've done an awesome job there. It's like it's a very minimal product philosophy. So it's not something that I personally use. It's almost like it's sort of too advanced for me. You kind of have to use like Tmux with it. But then I think Kitty is another popular terminal, which has some innovative features around like they're trying to push the borders of what you can do in the rendering. So I definitely would say there's been innovation, and we're just sort of trying to push it much further. Like we're trying to be like, you know, our basic thesis is like, Warp, as a terminal should be like as nice to use as any other app that you might come across using as a developer or as a knowledge worker or even as a consumer. And to me, that means it should be, you know, we're really focusing on making the user experience sort of like very powerful and delightful and discoverable. And we're also trying to like kind of push the boundaries of what a terminal traditionally has done. It's like terminals traditionally are like purely client side. And so for instance, we're, you know, on an opt-in basis, I want to be very clear, like we really do care about privacy and security, and we want people to opt into any sort of cloud feature that we do. But we think you could have a much more powerful terminal if like, for instance, you know, the terminal was collaborative, or the terminal, like you could share configuration with your teammates. You could potentially store your history. And so all of these things, we're really trying to like turn the terminal, you know, it's kind of been viewed as a utility, and we're trying to turn it into like a more useful product for people.
Yeah. I'm just still kind of going back to the website, and there's some really cool stuff in the pipeline. And I would love to see some of these things, like, for instance, yeah, I never tried with the sharing blocks, but I do like that. That could be really, really cool. But this real-time collaboration, I think, is really interesting. Like, I can't imagine how many times where I had to go outside for a meeting or something, and one of my employees was having a problem with something in the terminal, and it's like, no, just run this command. And then, like, you're over here trying to write the command almost exactly as you can, so they just copy and paste it. And you wish that you could just like, okay, let's just sit down with my laptop and then maybe I can somehow remote it and see what's going on.
Yeah. I mean, so I think it's an interesting feature. I think that the compelling use case there is what you just described. So it's like, you're trying to help a teammate debug something. There's some environment variable that's not set, or there's some, you know, sequence of commands that you want to just like jump in and run and help someone figure out how to solve a problem in the context of their terminal. That's definitely one use case. I think another really interesting use case is like when you're doing DevOps or SRE work and you are trying to sort of firefight and you have to use a bunch of text-based tools to do that firefighting, having the ability to have multiple engineers or SREs in one space feels like a really compelling thing, rather than trying to sort of facilitate it all through Zoom or Slack or some other outside channel. You know, there was this crazy Facebook outage yesterday, and like one of the things I would love to sort of ultimately understand is like how they were working to resolve it, but having a better set of tools for doing collaborative debugging of your production systems feels like potentially very powerful to me.
Yeah, I mean, man, there's just so much I could say about this. I'm just loving everything about Warp so far. It's just quite exciting. But one of the things I found interesting too is that you guys are also looking to do multi-platform, right? But you're still stuck on Mac. Like, is that because it's just like, I'm curious about what's the process about. One is how you decide to go to Mac, because I find a lot of Linux people are more interested in changing their terminal. It seems like with Mac, most people just use the default one already installed. And then two, like, you know, how difficult would it be to start changing things because you are really, really focused on Mac for the moment, it seems?
Yeah, it's a great question. We 100% want to support multi-platform. Our top our top requested feature on our GitHub issues right now is Linux support. It's purely a question of like engineering bandwidth. Like we're a like pretty small group of people working on this at the moment. And, you know, as a startup, what we're sort of trying to prove right now, prove it to ourselves really, is that we're building a feature set and a product that is really useful to at least some set of developers. And so, like the kind of framework we're using is we're trying to sort of maximize our learning right now and just make sure that what we're building is useful to people. Adding another platform will, you know, presumably help more users get access to Warp, but it doesn't really help us in terms of making sure that we're building the right things. So what we would rather do is just sort of make sure the product is like mostly right for some set of users. And let's say it's Mac users for now. And that's really because we're Mac users. It's not because we have some like inherent preference towards Mac. And then what we'll do is the next thing is support another platform. And it's actually not that heavy of a technical lift to do because we're using Rust. And one of the main selling points for us in terms of Rust, and we should talk about like why did we pick Rust, but one of the main selling points for us was the cross-platform support. And you know, there are some things that we need to sort of port to support another platform, but it's not like an insane amount of work because Rust cross-platform support is pretty good out of the box.
Yeah, how about we do this? I think this is a great idea to talk about why you chose Rust, but maybe we could just talk a little bit more about your background so people have an idea about, okay, why does this guy, you know, how does he think the way he thinks? And that would maybe make more sense about Rust, right? So if you always used to use C++ and you just got tired of the nonsense or whatever, maybe that makes a lot more sense and say, okay, this guy has a low-level program experience and, you know, he's looking for something better. But anyways, let's talk a little bit more about your background.
For sure. And actually, I can relate it to Rust fairly directly. So my background as an engineer is I spent a lot of time at Google as an engineer. And primarily at Google, I was first an engineer on Google Sheets, and then I was the engineering lead and manager for Google Sheets. And then I was the engineering lead for the Google Docs suite for a little bit. And, you know, what we did there was relatively similar in terms of technical challenges. Like building a collaborative spreadsheet is different than building a, like ultimately a collaborative terminal, but it's in the realm of types of software things you can work on. They're both productivity products, and they both have a bunch of really interesting technical challenges. Google Sheets is built, it has a very interesting technical architecture. So, you know, when you run it, it runs in the web browser. And so in some sense, it's obviously built in, JavaScript, and the UI runs in JavaScript. It runs in the DOM. But we also did a lot of cross compilation. So we also coded a lot of Google Docs in Java, and a lot of the server is in Java. And actually a lot of the client is, there's a code sharing mechanism that we developed to also compile that Java to JavaScript and run that in the client. And so we had this big cross-platform concern on Google Docs where we're trying to support, for us, the platforms were web, server, and then the native mobile platform, so iOS and Android. And we tried, you know, we ended up using Java as kind of our like kind of lowest level common denominator language for that. And I would say that it worked okay, but didn't work like incredibly well. Let me take that back. It works well, and I think Google Docs is a great product, but we had to put in tremendous amount of effort to get this to work in a cross-platform way. And we had to put in a tremendous amount of work to make it performant. And so when we were thinking about Warp and thinking about how to technically architect it, I really wanted to pick a framework and a language and a stack that was performance first and was cross-platform first. And so Rust was, you know, like we spent so much time trying to optimize the performance in the web stack. And I was just like, you know, if we're going to really build something for developers and really performance is going to be a first class concern, I don't want to develop it in the web stack. I want to develop it in the fastest possible stack. And like, you know, we weren't going to really write it in C++. I wanted something more ergonomic. I wanted something that could eventually compile for Linux and Windows, but also that could compile for the web, because I think we have interesting use cases around the web. And that's how we ended up picking Rust.
What about like Go though? Because I've seen a lot of people making GUI apps with Go, and Go is also another pretty cross-platform language. I think it's easier to compile cross-platform things where you just say Go compile or Go build, I think. And you could just name the architecture and it'll just build it, right?
So Go is interesting. I think the performance of Rust is significantly better. Go is still a garbage collected language, and I didn't want to use garbage collected language. We use Go on our server side. So we do use Go because I think it's a nice, it's like an easier language to code in my opinion, than Rust. Like, Rust is an incredible language, but you do, you end up spending a fair amount of time trying to understand its sort of rules on references and borrowing. And like, if you're coming from the world of like a garbage collected language, like sort of TypeScript or JavaScript, going to, you know, using Go is, I think, simpler. But for the actual client app, we wanted the sort of fastest possible thing. And I think the performance of Rust is significantly better than Go.
Oh, that's interesting. I'm curious why you guys just wouldn't try to write your Rust as the backend, because it seems like that's more and more possible these days.
I actually think we maybe will revisit that question, to be honest. Like, we were new to Rust when we started using it, and we sort of spun up Go on the server side more quickly. The other reasons to use Go, so it's like the sort of API support for like running services in Go versus Rust. I think Go is definitely more supported, especially we're using Google Cloud as our like public cloud provider. And so like our website and that type of stuff runs Google Cloud. And so I don't even think Google has an official Rust SDK for Google Cloud at the moment. I could be wrong, but I seem to remember when we looked at this before. And then, you know, it's like, if you're using, you know, your average sort of tool for like, let's say like monitoring or analytics or something like that, you still don't tend to see Rust SDKs quite as much. We do see some, but the general, for the parts of our app that I think are like not as performance intensive and like more like sort of bread and butter programming compared to the actual terminal client, like the decision we made was based on like, hey, there's just like more plug and play SDKs for Go. That said, we're considering switching it back to Rust because there are some obvious advantages for us in terms of being able to run some of the same code base on the server side as on the client. So we may actually go back to Rust on the server.
Yeah, that's interesting because somebody else mentioned this on a previous podcast episode, and like I can't help but keep thinking about like the whole entire left pad debacle where, you know, you can reuse cargo packages and you never know what's going to happen if you try to update a package or whatever and things break for whatever reason. It's like the package is slightly more suited for something else and then maybe it's more hard to work with.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big concern for any sophisticated project, and for us as well. It's like, what are the dependencies that we bring in? What are their licenses? What are their, how does the package management and the updates work? It is kind of a crazy, but very useful like world we have today, where you can just sort of like add something to your cargo TOML and you all of a sudden have like a bunch of functionality. But yeah, it's like it does add dependencies. It's interesting what that opens your app up to.
The other thing you have to be careful with too is like, you add one line of dependencies, but what does that one add in? What do they add in? So you kind of go back to this, to that old saying about OOP. But I think about it in this stage where it's like you want the banana, but you got the monkey in the whole jungle holding that banana. And it's like, oh my God, geez, just give me the banana.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's, you got to be careful too. It's like, we're trying to ship a binary that is pretty small, right? Like, we want the binary size to be reasonable. And it's like, you know, you just have to be aware of the dependencies that you're adding in and be careful about it for sure.
So I'm aware that this is basically a closed source system, right? But are you willing to talk about at least some of the things that you're using within your app? Because it's interesting to hear, like, to see the things that it's using. So what kind of packages are you actually using, or that you're willing to share at least?
Yeah. So we have this, some of this on our GitHub README. So we use, we have a dependency on some of Alacrity's code, which we use for terminal parsing, which has been super helpful. They have a very good package for VTE parsing. We use some completions from Fig's open source repo, which has been very helpful and useful. I don't know if you've seen Fig, but it's a cool tool that does some autocomplete stuff in terminals. We actually have another dependency on a project called Warp. There's a few Warps out there, and this is like a Warp web server project, which has been cool. We have a small dependency on some graphics code from a package called Pathfinder. We have a bunch of dependencies on Saturday, like some of the Saturday serialization, deserialization code, which has been super useful. We have a bunch of dependencies on Mac platform integrations that I think originally also came out of Saturday. So like, for instance, like, I think we use FontKit and we use a bunch of Objective-C bindings. So I think the people in Mozilla who were working on Warp early on did a bunch of these bindings into Mac platform code and like the Mac app runtime, which have been super useful for us. So we have quite a few open source dependencies, and we want to be really open about giving credit for those and like appreciate the work people with those other projects have done.
Yeah, definitely. I didn't even bother to go to you guys' GitHub. I'm glad you pointed that out. You do list out some of these open source dependencies that you're using. It's quite interesting. I never really thought too much about looking at Core Foundation, but that would make some sense. So that must be where you're getting a lot of the Mac bindings.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like that's one of the challenges with Rust is how do you interact with the Mac runtimes? And so, we ended up having to call into a bunch of Objective-C code. And, for instance, we do all of our own text layout. And if you want to do text layout on a Mac, like the right way to do it is to call into the Mac system libraries to help you basically figure out where the glyphs should go and how you should lay out the runs. And so there's a bunch of libraries we use to interface with that code.
Okay. Now I'd kind of like to talk a little bit more about like what's in, so you talked about the kind of some things that are all Rust specific, right? But you have a Mac app, right? There must be something written in Swift or Objective-C, I'm guessing. And you said that you do use some bindings. So to me, it sounds like you have some stuff written in at least Objective-C, I would say. So you're actually using Objective-C or Swift or both? Or
so we have no Swift. We have very minimal Objective-C. I would say like, I don't know, maybe we have 1,000 lines of Objective-C max. Most of what we do is we basically call like when you start Warp, what you're actually doing is you're running like a very bare bones like NS application. So it's like you're starting up, you're basically making the same call that a normal Mac app would make to set up an application. We have that application give us a window, and we have basically within that window, we get a view. And then after that, pretty much everything within there is done in the Rust layer, with the exception of in order to actually get the pixels onto the screen, we have to make calls into Metal. And so Metal, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's like Max graphics API. So it's basically Max, like native support. It's what you use in place of using OpenGL, essentially. So Metal has a shader language. Metal is what, if you want to write programs that run on the GPU. So if you want to write like, you know, fragment shaders and pixel shaders, you make calls to Metal. And so we basically do everything up to passing the data into Metal, into Rust, and then we pass it into Metal, and then it goes onto the GPU, and that's what actually ends up sort of rendering the terminal on screen.
A thousand lines seems like quite a bit, but it sounds like you have a lot more written in Rust than just a thousand lines.
Oh, yeah. I don't know what our total line count is in Rust, but yeah, no, we have. It's my guess is like that Objective C code is like 1 or 2% or something of our code base right now. And it's just for interfacing. And like, there's some native Mac like things that are just easier to write in Objective C. So if like, for instance, the menu bar, right? So it's like, we could write the menu bar in Rust and make a bunch of calls through the native, to directly bind into the Mac code, but it's just a very annoying way to write native Mac code. And so we just wrote some Objective-C code to do that type of stuff. But I do think it's, you know, we're trying to limit the amount of Objective-C just because when we go cross-platform, right, anything that's written in Objective-C will need to write in a different language.
Now, Objective-C, that's not really a garbage collected language, but they have this idea of ARC, right? And they kind of handle, because I think a long time ago they didn't have this. You had to actually manually save, retain, and release, I think. So
yeah, that's right.
Would you say that Objective-C is actually, it's not a garbage collected language, right? Like, how does it compare with Rust?
It's not garbage collected. It's reference counted. It's very dynamic. And so I don't know. Like, I don't know exactly the performance characteristics of Objective-C, but I don't think it's as performant as Rust because there is this, like, there's a bunch of stuff in terms of runtime, the way that it, like, invokes methods and sends messages and, like, it has, like, a much more significant runtime is my understanding of Objective-C compared to Rust. Objective-C is a fine language. I've built, you know, iOS apps in it. So I don't really have anything like negative to say, but I do prefer working in Rust to working in Objective-C these days for sure.
How do you like the bracket syntax?
It's a little weird. I prefer Rust syntax. I don't love it.
Yeah. I don't know. I kind of like doing it, but at the same time, it just was a little bit weird because sometimes you have to like do a couple of method calls. And so you're doing brackets within brackets and it just gets a little bit goofy.
Yeah, it gets goofy. The method names are like super long because of the way they do the arguments. It's okay. I haven't really ever programmed in Swift. So I know people really love programming in Swift, but I haven't done much of that.
Now, is there a reason why you guys chose Objective-C? Because I think even Apple's trying to push more and more people over to Swift.
It's a good question. I think when it came down to it, a bunch of the dependencies that we have, like for instance, those like font kit dependencies and like, I feel like there's much better Rust crate support for working with Objective-C relative to Swift. Like for instance, we have Rust macros that actually like write, let us like just like natively invoke something as though we're invoking it in Objective-C. And I don't know if those same types of bindings exist for Swift. So I think some of it was just like, what do our dependencies do? And it was easier to do it in Objective-C than to do it in Swift.
I find that so interesting because even when you go to the docs for like Apple, they always like, which one you want, Swift or Objective-C? Like they make it seem like it's only syntax changes. At least that's kind of like the feeling I get when I look at the docs.
Right. I do think Swift is supposed to be faster, but it's a good question. This is not my area of expertise.
It's also kind of interesting too, because I think LLVM and Swift have like a really tight knit, right? Because I think the guy who did Swift also did LLVM and Clang or something.
I think that's right. Yeah.
So I don't know, I just think it's kind of interesting. You're marrying the two languages. This is kind of funny, just ironic.
Yeah.
But So actually, I am kind of curious, like maybe other people out there are also kind of curious, like if I ever wanted to marry Rust with Mac or iOS, is it that you, so it sounds like it's Objective-C is talking with or using Rust libraries, right? Or is it that Rust is using both ways? Okay.
You can go both directions. So there's, I think it's called the foreign function interface. I'm blanking on the exact name of it, but basically you can do it. You can bind into Objective-C code. So you can call into it and then you can also have it call back to you. So it's like, you can basically like implement a delegate, and have Rust answer like the callbacks, or you can sort of directly invoke like, hey, I want to call this like Objective-C method, like set view, something like that. There's Rust libraries that let you basically compile in such a way that you can pass compatible structures back and forth. I don't know sort of the details of the technical implementation. I know it more from a user standpoint, and it's like, it's kind of annoying, but it works. It's unsafe. So you lose the, you lose like the safety guarantees of Rust when you do it, because you're going into another runtime. And so it's like totally possible to like leave a dangling reference or that kind of thing. But it's also, I think if you're going to build a native Mac app, I don't really know how you do it without interfacing with native Mac libraries. So it's cool that Rust makes it not too hard.
Okay. Yeah, that's true. It's interesting that you can go both ways. I mean, I'm kind of also curious about what is your build pipeline, right? Because you're building two different things. So is it that you build like an SO and then you just link the SO directly into your Mac app, or how does it kind of work?
So we build it like a single binary, and then we distribute it as like a Mac bundle. So it's like, it's distributed as like a Mac app, and that comes with like, we use this tool called Cargo Bundle, which is actually pretty cool. And it will take your Rust binary and then create like a dot app out of it. And so that like ships with all the resources. And then when you run it, it sort of looks, I believe the way it works is that it looks for those SOs that are like the Mac sort of framework dependencies that it expects, and then calls into them dynamically at the runtime. So it's like, we don't ship like a compiled version of like NS application or something like that. It's like, that's hooking into whatever the runtime of the machine that it's running on, has, which I think is how most, Mac apps end up actually working. But we ship like one executable that's just like a regular, like binary compiled for Mac.
I was just curious, like, just that you build the Rust part first and then you link it into the Mac app and then the Mac app will get built? Or you're saying Cargo Bundle, you just run Cargo Bundle and somehow it's able to actually hook into, I guess you have like a side link Mac app, like base Mac application that would somehow get bundled up. I'm still not quite exactly clear.
So I don't want to miss it because I could be wrong, maybe not, don't fully understand the details, but you can basically do like Cargo build for us, right? And you'll get a single binary where if you go into like target debug arm, you know, and in there will be a binary called warp. And if you just like straight up run that binary, it will launch. And I'm pretty sure that we're not linking into that any, like specific Mac, like runtime stuff. I'm pretty sure that what ends up happening is when we run it, it like does some sort of dynamic loading and basically runs against like the platform's like whatever its NS application SO code is. But I could be wrong here, and I don't want to be wrong about it on the podcast. But I believe that's how it's working, because you can literally just do a raw Cargo build and then run warp right from the command line, and it will it'll run.
Okay. I'm actually kind of curious about, what's the business model of warp, right? Because right now there's no, it's like a private beta, at least for the current time being that we're recording this. I'm guessing at some point it'd probably be more of a public beta. I'm not too sure what's in your pipeline, but like how, what is Warp planning to do? Is it planning to be some kind of SaaS model? How do you guys plan to support yourself?
Yep, that's a great question. So yeah, the next step for us is a public beta. I don't exactly know when that will be. My best guess would be like 3 to 6 months, something like that. The eventual sort of business that we want to build is not charging individual developers for using a terminal. That feels like maybe it's possible, but feels like a hard sell. So we're not building like, superhuman for the terminal or something like that. What we would like to do is build a product that is awesome for developers to use as individuals. They use that as individuals for free. And then there's some sort of connected SaaS services that are around like collaboration or sharing or securing the terminal or making it work in the context of a business that we would eventually want businesses to pay for. I think a pretty good a good comparison for the business model would be something like Postman. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that tool, but it's like a tool that lets you. Are you familiar or should I?
I'm definitely familiar and I kind of hate it with a passion. I don't know. I just feel the UI is so complicated. I use Palm a lot.
We're not trying to emulate the UI, but the business model is something like, you use it to your heart's delight as an individual. And then if you find use for it in your team or in your company, there are different plans that you pay for. I don't know exactly what set of features are going to be compelling for a company for the command line, but where my head goes would be things like real-time collaboration or like making it very easy to onboard engineers into a terminal environment or making it very easy to like firefight, a production incident in a terminal and have like a record of what you've done that you can use to build a postmortem. Adding workflows around supporting sign off for certain types of commands. And so these types of features that make a terminal more useful in the context of a company are the things that I'm interested eventually in us building a business around, but it's not really the short-term priority. The short-term priority is like, can we build a great product in the command line that helps developers be more productive?
I'm just thinking like I used to work in this software vendor and it's highly regulated, like all these, everything you do, you have to really keep a record of. And I could just imagine like maybe somebody like that, although I know you guys are focused on privacy, but I couldn't imagine that these guys would love to have a way to record like, okay, you type this command, you type that command, kind of keep track of certain things, especially when incidents happen, right? How you resolve an incident is super important. Yeah. Like we just discussed about with Facebook. How this change got pushed in? What was there a step that was missed? And also, like, how did we resolve it?
Yeah, exactly. I'm fascinated by that. I do think that, from a privacy perspective, I think it's really important that it's A, super transparent, and B, it's opt-in. Anything that is like leaving the context of like your local device. That said, I do think companies. I could see a lot of value if they are able to basically give all their employees a terminal that has centralized like auditing and centralized firefighting capabilities and postmortems and like exactly what you said, being able to like trace the breadcrumbs of an incident and then use that same tool to help resolve the incident. And so I think that that's like a major use case I would love us to support. I think it's eventually something that will be very valuable for companies. I think like related to that is actually securing the terminal environment would be very valuable to companies. But it's not what we're leading with. And it's like our focus right now is purely on like, let's make developers really happy and let's do it in like a very privacy friendly, like transparent and opt-in way.
I want to talk a little bit more about Warp the company, right? Are you guys a funded company? Are you self-funded? What's kind of, if you are funded, I guess you must have some kind of business pitch that you're pitching to people, and that'd be interesting to kind of share.
Yep. So we are funded. We haven't made any kind of formal funding announcement, so I don't want to sort of disclose who our investors are. But the business pitch is basically what I just said, which is that, you know, eventually we believe that there is value in companies having a sort of better terminal experience for their developers. And the way that we would like to get that is for developers to want to use the product and to sort of bring it into their companies, and sort of in a similar way right now, a developer might be like, hey, I want to pay for, you know, JetBrains. I want to pay for IntelliJ, or I want to pay for C-Line or something like that. We want developers to want to use this product and have their companies pay for it, because the companies believe it's making their developers more productive, more collaborative, making the development environment more secure, those types of things. So that's like our pitch. That's the sort of business model, and that's why some people have invested in helping the company succeed. And I actually think having the investors is an important thing for us, from the standpoint of, like, you know, we're a team of eight. And so we have, it's me, it's this guy who used to lead design on Google Docs, CQ, he's our founding designer, and it's six engineers. And I feel like we wouldn't be able to, basically have such an awesome group of people working full time on making this product awesome if we didn't have a way of, like, paying them. And so that's, like, why I think it's in our interest right now to sort of raise capital and try to make this a commercial venture.
How do you guys actually validate your idea before you start to really dig into it some more?
Yeah, so it's a great question. So we do a bunch of stuff. So we talk to a bunch of developers. It helps that we are all developers. So it's like, it's very cool to be working on a product that we all use all day. And so when stuff doesn't work well, we have our own sort of intuitions and desires on how to fix it. We have now a Discord community, which has like over 1,000 developers in it. And we're trying to get feedback on things that we might build by going to Discord. We ask users to vote up our GitHub issues, and so we take feedback there. It's basically just like, you know, what we're doing right now is a mix of trying to innovate. And so on the one hand, we're trying to move the terminal further and, like, create things like blocks and create the rich input area and sharing features and that type of stuff. But we also have a lot of just sort of table stakes stuff that we have to fix that people expect to be really polished and good in a terminal. And, like, you know, so we're trying to take everyone's input and prioritize how we fix those things. And so, like, for instance, like, Warp is not very customizable right now. It's, like, very minimally customizable. And that's definitely an annoyance and a pain for our users. And so we're trying, like, they've made that clear. And, like, we're trying as fast as we can to sort of build the things that people are asking for.
Don't you feel, I feel like if I was in your shoes, I'd feel so annoyed. Like, man, we're giving you guys awesome features and all you care about is colors and making things customized. Like, come on, man.
I get it. It's like, let's say you've been using one set of, like, keyboard shortcuts your entire life, and then you come into Warp and, like, the first thing you're going to try and do is use those, and then they might not work. And then you're going to be like, what the heck? And then you're going to be like, can I set it up to have my keyboard shortcuts? And right now the answer is no, frankly, which is annoying. And so I feel super sympathetic with users about that. And we're, things like that, we're trying to prioritize just so, we want to be in a spot where the vast majority of people who use Warp don't take any step backwards in their productivity. They should only be moving forwards. But we're not there yet, but we're, you know, every week we're putting out a new release, and it's definitely getting better every week, which is cool to see.
I am also kind of curious about when you're writing in Rust, right? What is your typical setup? Like, for me, I usually use IntelliJ with the Rust thing built in, because I just like clicking buttons. I like clicking play, and then watching it build or running whatever, and I could just drop down and click which one I want because I can't remember all the cargo build commands or all the cargo extensions I want to add in. Like, what's your kind of typical setup?
So me personally, I use VS Code, and then I use VS Code for the code editing, and I use Warp for all of the like build, run, like debug, package management, all that stuff. Other people on the team, some of them use CLion, which is another JetBrains product, which I think has a very similar experience to if you're using IntelliJ with Rust. And then some people on the team use Vim. Like it's a real mix. We're all using Warp as the terminal, but on the code editing side, we use a bunch of different things.
Okay. So, I don't know. Is there anything else you think people should know about Warp or yourself or anything else before I have just a couple of last questions to ask?
I mean, the only other thing is like, since we're not in a full public release yet, but we are letting people in every week. And sort of, if people want to try it right now, the best way to try it is to actually join our Discord. And then every week we sort of do a drop of new codes as we feel like the app is becoming more stable and we're ready to take more people on. You can also join the waitlist, and we are letting people off the waitlist. We're just doing it at a sort of gradual pace. And we would, we would love people to come check it out. The other thing is we're building the team, and we're looking for awesome Rust engineers. And if you have an interest in the command line, an interest in the product space, and you want to be working in Rust, it's a pretty technically interesting and exciting thing to work on, and it's a really great group of people. So that's one last thing I would mention.
Okay, no, that's good to hear. And now, it seems like more and more people are hiring for Rust, so that's good. And this is a fantastic terminal to get into. I think I would love to be a part of that and just like see how everything kind of works it's kind of interesting that you're building something and then using it again to build it again. It's like Inception. Yes. Almost.
It's very Inception. Like you can run Warp from within Warp and then run it again. You can just keep doing it. It's it's pretty fun. It's like we're making the tool and using the tool to debug it as we make it. It's pretty fun.
So I think the proper term for that is called dog fooding, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's great. They always say if you want to build something, build it for yourself because you would know the most or whatever. Obviously you're there, right?
So absolutely.
Makes a lot more sense. So I think my kind of like last question that I always like to ask people is like, you came from really not knowing too much Rust to now being pretty, I would say much more proficient. Is there any kind of tips or tricks or something that you want to let people know who are maybe beginning in Rust or starting to live more intermediate that you think they should really know?
We're relatively new in Rust. Like, and the way that I got up to speed, I guess there were a couple things. So one is like I'm a book learner. So I like read cover to cover the O'Reilly Rust book, which to me, it's kind of how I learned JavaScript back in the day in Java as well, and how I like to learn a language. We also used Rustlings. I don't know if you know that tool. And then there's a couple, like I also read the online, like the official Rust book, and that was super helpful. And then the other thing that we had like, the good fortune to do was we brought some people onto the team who were like more expert in Rust. And so having some people who like you can work with who are good at it is obviously also a huge advantage. And so that helps accelerate our learning. I don't know if that's practical for everyone, but working with someone who really knows the language is a great way to get much better at it.
Yeah, no, that's great. You can always bounce things off to people and pick up some tricks here and there. I just can't imagine like being like my first day and like everybody's like huddled around you like, hey man, can you help me out with this?
Yeah, I will say it's a real learning curve. Like the sort of model of lifetimes and passing around references and everything having an owner is like a mental shift. And I guess the encouragement I would give people is like, you know, you do it and you fight with the compiler and it's super frustrating at the beginning. And then you do it enough and it starts to make more and more and more sense until it kind of just feels like more natural. So I do think it's a hard language, but I think it's a language that's worth learning. And if you learn it, and this, I'm stealing a line from someone I've worked with, but if you learn it, you kind of get this superpower of like having the ability to build a very high performance app, which is like a pretty good superpower. I think it's worth investing in as like a technical skill. And I actually think, I think the future is really bright for building things in Rust.
I'm actually kind of curious, did you guys also take a look at Zig or no?
I haven't taken a look at Zig, no.
Okay.
Like, yeah, I don't know what Zig is.
Zig is similar with Rust and some, I need to take a look at it, but I know of one guy who basically puts down Rust and saying Zig is so much better. I would say Zig, I just tell you what, he's really into Zig versus Rust. And I've heard some people looking at Zig for stuff. So I would say it's, again, don't quote me yet. So now it's my turn to give my kind of disclaimers. Don't quote me on saying, you know, what I'm saying right now. But what I understand is Zig is basically similar to Rust in that it's kind of like a replacement or upgrade to C, C++. It's got some more niceties to it. Like, I heard that Zig actually has like the really nice way to cross-compile build things as opposed to Rust. It's a little bit more complicated. You have to choose between muscle or whatever. I have to take a look again, but yeah, I've heard good things about Zig. I haven't heard anything bad about Zig necessarily. People don't talk about finding bar checkers, etc. Yeah. I'm just curious if you ever took a look at that. Other than that, I think that's it. Is there anything else you kind of wanted to say before we wrap up? I think you kind of gave your spiel already.
Thank you so much for having me on, Al. It was great to get to chat with you about war.
No, it's great to have you on. And again, I thank you for building a really awesome terminal app. And I'm glad that, you know, I feel a little bit guilty. I kind of used my position to get a beta invite, but nonetheless, I'm happy that I got to play with it. And I'm happy that I can let people know about it. And I passed out at least one invite to somebody. So if anybody wants an invite, I think I have another 9 or so to give out. So you can just at me on Twitter if you want one.
Cool. All right, Alan. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for your time.